One of my big frustrations with reading books is I'm like, this is way too long. Mm. This is a little extreme, but I view the Mappiness Project as an indictment on modern life. Introverts, extroverts are getting the equivalent mood boost from being around people. We're living through an explosion of data that is transforming our understanding of the most important areas of human life.
All right, Seth. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. I'm a big fan of your work, big fan of your writing, and I'm excited to dive into you, your story today.
Thanks for having me, Danny.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd love to start with your college paper on a New York Yankees playoff game.
Oh, college essay.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, we have a mutual friend, Nick Majuli, and he told me that Danny does his homework, and you're the only one. I don't even know where you got that from. So you certainly do your homework. Yes, my college essay was about how much I love sports, which is like the first thing you're not. I think I always have this thing in life when people say don't do something, I want to do it and see that, show that it can be done. And the worst thing for a young male to do applying to college when they say write an essay about something you're passionate about is sports. It's like, no, literature, business, the last thing, I'm a sports fan. But sports was such a big part of my life and being a sports fan that I thought I'd see if I could write an essay that was interesting. And I started getting into philosophy, how it connects my interest in philosophy, my interest in journalism, my interest in data, all these different areas. And the essay was featured this playoff game, game 2, Yankees Mariners. It was in 1996, I think. 15-inning game ends with Jimmy Laritz hitting a home run, two-run home run to win the game. And I was with there, my dad and I, in the left field bleachers, Yankee Stadium. And I just said how much sports just brings everyone together. I just started hugging all these random people I just met from totally different walks of life. And that was kind of how I ended my essay. And it worked. I got to Stanford with an essay on how much I love sports, which, yeah, is the last thing. If they gave you advice on what to not write an essay on, it would probably be how much you love sports.
Yeah, well, your dad was also a professor at NYU,
correct? Yeah, that's right.
Did that impact you growing up and ability to communicate and take stories and translate into the written things that you could talk about?
Yeah, so my dad's a professor of journalism. NYU, and some people say like that I am really good at writing and telling stories.
You are.
And I'm like, I'm Tiger Woods of this. I had that dad pushing me from a very, very young age. And my mom's a writer too.
Wow.
So both my parents are writers. My dad was helping me a ton. He still does. I still send him most things I write and still get incredibly useful feedback. So it definitely, there's that advice, use your unfair advantage in life. And definitely from a writing perspective, my dad's and my mom have been unfair advantages.
What types of things do your parents help you with, in particular with writing?
My mom just tells me when she's bored and always adding more fun things, fun words. Like in one sentence in Don't Trust Your Gut, I'm like, what makes people attractive in dating? And my mom crossed it out and said, what makes people catnip in the dating market? And I'm like, yeah, thank you, Mom. That is more fun than my writing. So little things like that, my mom really helps with it. My dad he's been teaching journalism he just retired. He taught it since he was 26 years old or something. So yeah, 40 plus years of teaching journalism at NYU. So he helps me on everything. I don't know. I can't even, anything you could possibly be helped on, my dad helps me in my writing. So
yeah, it's awesome. So this book, what I love about it is it's almost like 10 different books.
Yeah.
Each chapter could be its own book. And it's like, they're all connected, but they're all, it's like, I could imagine you just sitting down and being like, okay, I'm going to write this one now. And like spending time on just that specific section. And I really like that. And so what was the process for creating these different chapters? How do you go about taking something that's like an idea in your head to a full chapter or a full book?
Well, so that's intentional that each chapter could be a book, because one of my big frustrations with reading books is I'm like, this is way too long. Mm. And this should have been an article. It should have been a chapter. It didn't need to be this, you know, you get the point already. And I feel like nobody could say that for my book because each, I have one chapter or two chapters on happiness. I have one chapter on getting rich. I have one chapter on getting lucky. I have one chapter on entrepreneurship, one chapter on parenting, one chapter on dating. And it's kind of like I feel like at least nobody can say this book is like way longer than it needs to be. People might say it's shorter. It's just whetting their appetite. And, you know, I usually include other books you can read if you're really passionate about it. But that was intentional to focus on a wide range of topics and hopefully people wouldn't get bored and be like, I already got the point, because it'd be totally different points. And, the process, once you kind of come up with the big idea of the book, I'd say, is this idea of Moneyball for your life. That I am a huge baseball fan, as I told all the colleges when I was applying. And I'm obsessed with baseball, and baseball's been revolutionized by stats. And the idea is, well, but when we make our big decisions in life, you know, how to date, how to pick a career, how to be happier, I feel like we're in the pre-Moneyball stage where you just kind of do what feels about right. And I'm like, what if we actually took data to some of these biggest questions? And once you pitch it as that, some of the biggest questions, the chapters kind of decide themselves. Mm-hmm. So obviously you have to have a chapter on dating. Obviously you have to have a chapter on parenting. Obviously you have to have a chapter on happiness, getting rich, luck, like all these things. It kind of wrote itself, it outlined itself. Then you have to do the research and figure out what to say on each chapter.
So you start with the outline and then find studies to back it up, or you find studies and then look at the outline?
Yeah. So I had all the chapters that I wanted to cover, but I had no idea what I wanted to say on any chapter. And that also was intentional, because I feel like most people, when they write an advice book, I guess it's a self-help book, you have something you want to say, and then you just find a study that confirms it. And you can find a study that says anything, you know, coffee is good for you, coffee is bad for you, use timeout for your kids, don't use timeout for your kids. Like there's a study out there for any point you want to make. Yeah. And this, I had zero idea what I wanted to say on any of these topics, nothing, no idea. I'm just like, I'm going to read the studies. And usually what I found is there's one project that's only been done in the last, like, you know, few years that is just so revolutionary and kind of just kills all the other projects and is so much cooler than everything else. And I really went deep into those and then, you know, used some other studies to back them up. But mostly I just found if I thought the methodology was cool, then I just said whatever the study said, because rather than wanting to say something than finding a study to back it up. So
yeah, one of those studies that you found, or one of the projects you found, was the mappiness.
Yeah.
That was amazing to me. Where they pinged people during the day and saw how happy they were at certain points. Why was that so revolutionary? Yeah, yeah. Why did you like get so excited by that one?
Yeah, so that's this project, George McCarran, Susanna Morado, these British economists. And I was reading all these studies on happiness, and I'm just like, even famous studies that I had heard about, I read about, most of them, I'm just like, this study is total crap. I'm being serious. How did we build happiness advice based on asking, you know, 200 undergrads some random question? And what makes this does this make you happy? Okay, that's what makes us happy. I'm like, that's not convincing at all. And then I hadn't known about this mappiness project, and the sample sizes were just enormous. And they could do these things from an economics background. Economics is really into these natural experiments. So kind of see what happens, random changes in the world, see how that affects things. And mappiness sample, the 3 million data points, they could do all these studies like a sports one. One of their cooler studies was with George McCarran and Professor Peter Dalton, is they compared what happens when your favorite team wins and loses a game to your happiness. And they found when your team wins, you gain 4 points of happiness. When your team loses, you lose 8 points of happiness.
Wow.
So basically the average sports fan is making a terrible bet from a happiness standpoint, in that the wins are not giving you the pleasure. The pain you get from the losses are just so much bigger than the pleasure you gain from the wins. It's almost like a drug. And even when you root for a good team, you're like, okay, well, now I just need to root for a good team, so at least I'll get the 4 points with more consistency. When you root for a good team, you just get much less pleasure from the wins and much more pain from the losses, that you still are screwed. Wow. No matter how you look at it, the average sports fan is getting more pain from their team's games than on average, they're getting pain from their games. It's almost like a drug. It's pretty enlightening.
On that point, it's interesting because that falls in line with the research about losing money is more painful than winning money is good, similar to the gambling studies.
Yeah, loss aversion.
Loss aversion, exactly.
Yeah. It falls in that. But there's a kind of kicker to that research, was the other thing that Mappy has found is, in general, people are pretty happy watching sports. And the key to reconcile that that when your team plays, you get more pain from the losses than pleasure from the win, but on average, you're happy watching sports, is you're happy watching sports of teams you don't care about.
Yeah.
That's basically the only way to reconcile that. And I've done that in my own life. I'm a huge baseball fan, as I said, and the Mets and Yankees are actually pretty good this year, the New York teams. But I'm finding myself, instead of watching the Mets or Yankees game, I watch, the Warriors-Celtics play. And I don't have a dog in the race. I don't care. But it's fun. You can just appreciate, wow, Steph Curry's amazing or Jason Tatum's amazing. And it's more fun to watch that than watch your own teams. It's less like a drug.
Well, it's more like an art form. You're appreciating art at that point. So it's cool that you can find that level of enjoyment from something like that. So what made you look at that and say, okay, like I should stop being so invested? Like I remember listening to a podcast you did and you were like, I saw this research and I stopped watching Knicks games. It's like, is that taking it too far? Or is it like using the data to inform your life?
So you really do your homework. I will say that. I'm trying to even remember what podcast I said. I think I know. I remember which podcast I said that on. But I think, so what I try to do, and, you know, again, readers, if they read the book, they can decide if they agree or disagree, is I really am rigorous in the studies I include.
Yeah.
That I don't just, there's a new study that was just featured in the New York Times. If you drink coffee, you have a 30%, it lowers your mortality rate by 30%.
Saw that. I was like, is that true? I gotta ask you.
No, it is not true. It's a correlational study. Clearly what they're missing is that coffee drinkers differ from non-coffee drinkers in many fundamental ways that they're just never gonna be able to correct for, and it wasn't a randomized trial. It was just totally unconvincing. So I made zero changes to my coffee intake based on that study. But when I read something like the Mappiness Project, where I'm like, wow, this is just a total natural experiment. It's, you know, it's totally convincing. It's very rare. So I'd say 1,000, if I read 1,000 studies, which I estimate, and I don't think I'm exaggerating. I read maybe, if you probably listened to my podcast, so I probably give a different number each time. So maybe I haven't done the estimate, but it's thousands. I read thousands of studies.
Yeah.
I would say 1 in 100 at the best would lead to a change in my behaviors. So 99 out of 100, either I don't believe the study or it's on a trivial point that's not gonna lead to a big change. But occasionally the methodology will be so compelling and the question so fundamental that I will make a massive change in my life based on what the data says.
What should somebody be looking at when they see a study who isn't a data scientist, who doesn't read papers? Like, what should we be looking out for that says, oh, this is legit, or, oh, I should change my life based on this?
Yeah, so I think a big thing is the methodology, the sample size, so the Mappiness methodology. You know, compare, like, just think about it. How much more are you able to say when you, tens of thousands of people, you're pinging them in the iPhone in the moment, saying how happy you are, and you build a data set of 3 million people? Whoa, that's pretty powerful stuff compared to you read a paper and they did some random experiment with, usually it's a random experiment. They showed a team of undergraduates a comedy bit and another team of undergraduates something else. And they made some grand lesson about happiness based on 40 people. And it's just like, no, that's not, there's so much wrong with that approach. So it's kind of a big data set, something very, using some sort of new tool that hasn't previously been available, that's much more comprehensive, not just a little group of undergrads. And then how are they dealing with causality? That's kind of another question. Are they properly comparing correlation to causality? But a lot of it's the data set. So this chapter on wealth and who's secretly rich in America, which I know Danny liked because I said that independent creatives is not as a bad bet. And I like it too because we're both independent creatives now. And it was the first study that analyzed the entire universe of American taxpayers and said who, and listed in a chart members of the top 0.1% or top 1% of income earners. So just stop and think, is that an important study for understanding how the world works and for making decisions how to pick a career? You don't have to be a data scientist. Okay, the first study to look comprehensive tax data of who's in the top 0.1%. Yeah, that's an important study. That's going to change how you make decisions. That's not just, we asked a few people, what do you think makes people rich? That's actually the data, the entire universe of data. So I think the more you do it, the more you understand. But you definitely, I mean, just think of the methods. I think it's pretty commonsensical. What's new about this study? What's different about this study? If it's the entire universe of taxpayers, there's 3 million pings on iPhones about what makes people happy. If it's a study of 11,000 romantic relationships and what predicts happiness, as I talk about in the book, when previous studies had been about 40 couples, yeah, that's going to be an important study. So
the universe of the amount of people is very important.
Yeah, for sure.
So in that, you brought up the richest people are auto dealership owners and beverage distributors. How, when you look at data like that, how do you differentiate between what has happened versus what will happen in the future?
Yeah. Well, subtle point, not the richest people. So the richest people are Elon Musk and Bill Gates.
Right.
So the richest, 100 people in the world. But I think what was interesting about this study, Capitalist in the 21st Century, is it studied the more than 140,000 people who earn more than $1.6 million per year. Mm-hmm. So it's not saying the few hundred billionaires, which we kind of all know who the few hundred billionaires are, but you're probably not going to end up one of those 400 people. But could you end up in the top 0.1% of earners? Maybe. And then understanding who they are. And they had a sentence in that paper that kind of was like, certainly it was a wow moment for me, where they said the typical rich American is the owner of a mid-sized regional business, such as an auto dealer or beverage distributor. And I said that I hadn't known, though a lot of people have criticized me because I have a PhD in economics, you should have known this, just how cushy auto dealers had it. And I admitted, which people are hammering me, that I did not know what a beverage distributor was. So I'm like, oh, that's very interesting. And you kind of learn what it takes to be rich. The first thing in being rich is the value of owning versus being a wage earner. So among the top 0.1%, the ratio of people who are making most of their money from business income to salary is about 3-1. So if you look at the top 10%, top 5%, top 1%, it's salaried. Then you get to the top 0.1%, it's business, it's owning. And it's even more extreme if you get to the top 0.01%. So Nick Madjuli in his book, Just Keep Buying, who's, I know, a friend of the show,
friend
of the podcast and a friend of ours, as I mentioned, is he points out that the richest NFL player in history is Jerry Richardson.
Yeah. Not Jerry Rice.
And Jerry Rice caught, I think, 1,500 passes. Jerry Richardson caught like 15 passes. He played for two seasons. He was a crappy wide receiver. And then he just started buying up Hardee's and became a billionaire out of that, which just shows the extreme value of owning, even a great athlete is being paid by the owners who are much richer than they are. And so owning is number one. Second big thing in getting rich is it's probably something unsexy. Not always. So the independent creatives offer a little twist, but the worst businesses, there was a study by two statisticians, and they studied every business in a region of the United States and how quickly it folds. And the average dentist business lasts 19.5 years. The business that's absolute quickest to fold, record store, 2.75 years. And the other ones, toy store, clothing store, beauty supply store. It's just like a bloodbath. You could imagine if you're watching a movie and there have been, how many movies have there been about record store owners? People just watch that movie. Everybody says, now I'm going to start a record store. It's disaster. It's not happening. Don't try it. Never going to happen. But then, so probably something unsexy, though there's a little twist with the independent creatives. And then the third thing is a local monopoly. So that's what's happening with the auto dealership and beverage distributor is they are legally protected local monopolies where there are laws that prevent car companies or beer companies from distributing their product themselves. And then there's some regional protections that someone can't necessarily just start a competing business right next to you. And I think people just, even if you understand the value of owning your own business for getting rich, people don't quite understand how hard it is to avoid price competition. So I think the average person, some people know, like just the difference between owning an auto dealership and an auto repair shop. So they're both, there's nothing, one's not more difficult than the other. An auto repair shop takes a lot of skill, takes a lot of hard work. So does owning an auto dealership. There, you probably don't even need that much more education to own one the other. But the percent of people who are entering the 0.1% in an auto repair shop is less than 1%. It didn't even make the chart because there are so few people. I'm not sure there's anybody who's owning an auto repair shop and entering the 0.1%, whereas 20% of owners of auto dealerships are in the top 0.1% and many more in the top 1% and some of them top 0.01%. And that's because auto repair shop, there's nothing to prevent someone from starting a competing auto repair shop right next to you and then you're just in a price war and you have to, the only way that, and you're competing with each other on Google ads to try to get business, there is kind of no local monopoly in that situation. If there's no possibility of local monopoly, it's almost impossible to get rich. So even people understand the value of owning, probably underestimate before you go into a business what's going to be your local monopoly. And independent creatives, who I was surprised in the tax data, there seemed to be more than 10,000 independent creatives entering the top 1%, and many of them entering also the top 0.1%, where they're literally making millions of dollars a year.
The top 1% is how much?
That's like 400,000 about per year.
Per year.
And then the top 0.1% is 1.6 million. It kind of rises over time. And the key to that is that independent creatives allow local monopolies. Say what you will. It's a dream job, whatever. But, you know, the Danny Miranda podcast, you're building a fan base. And eventually you want to get to a place where,
I could sell out Madison Square Garden.
Where you don't have to get that place. Just get to a place where you have a podcast, you have me on the show, and someone else has me on the show, and everyone listens to your show. All your fans listen to your show. And even if you ask the same question, the other person goes and says, so local monopoly means even if you're doing the same exact thing as someone else, you can get fans. That's what you really want in business.
Right.
And you want to ultimately be at a point, as much as you do your homework, where first of all, you want to get to a point where you don't have to do that much homework or you're paying someone else to do the homework for you. Maybe. Okay, but you want to get to a point where even if someone else asked me the exact same questions, they start with the sports essay and they did their homework just as much.
Yeah.
People are going on your podcast and you can get to that point. And the other thing that makes independent creatives a way better bet than I had thought before I looked at the data is you massively increase your odds with hustle more than just about any other career I've encountered in the data, where just putting work out there, traveling widely, networking, like just anytime they've done a study of what independent creatives succeed, the odds, people who hustle versus those who don't hustle, you're increasing your odds sixfold, tenfold, just enormous increase. So even if the overall odds are 1% or whatever, if you're hustling, you're already 10, 20%. You just leap ahead of everybody else if you're really, really hustling at the highest level. So that's what that's why I think if you're young and you're willing to hustle and you have a little bit of talent, I think independent creative is not a bad bet, which I wouldn't have said before. Before I wrote this book, before I read these studies, if someone said, I want to be an independent creative, I would have said,
terrible idea.
Start an auto repair business. Now I know, no, actually, auto repair business is an awful business. Independent creative is actually way better because it allows a local monopoly.
Right. So is an example of you hustling and reaching out and spreading yourself widely, walking up to James Altucher?
That's true. James Altucher, I was a fan of his, and I contacted him. We met him at a coffee shop, and that allowed me to be on his podcast, be kind of friendly with him. And I hustled more than a lot of people realize in my career. It just that's an example. There are a lot of other examples.
Lunch with Danny Kahneman.
Lunch with Danny Kahneman.
How'd you get that opportunity?
Reaching out. Just wow. You reach out. Most people don't reach out. I'm surprised how few people reach out. You reach out to the top. I think you're already in the top
1%. Yeah.
I'd say you're top 5% of independent creatives if you send cold emails to people you admire asking to meet for lunch.
Yeah.
Like that's so easy. And that's the top 5%, let alone the things you could do that would, you know, that sometimes you read these stories of independent creatives and you're like Howard Stern was knocking on people's doors trying to get guests, and people have been like showing up at celebrities' doors, handing them their screenplay. And so that's the top 0.1% probably, but just reaching out to people you admire and asking them for phone calls, coffees, lunches, that's top 5%.
What was your process? What is your process for doing something like that? You stumble, is it like, I gotta reach out to X number of people a week, or do you have a specific way of formatting messages? Like, how do you get people like this to agree?
It depends. So I also say in the book that I think flooding the market's probably an underrated life strategy.
Yes.
So dating's a great example of this, where they've done studies of what happens when they've rated people's photos and they've looked at the data from online dating sites. What happens when a 1 asks out a 10? And I thought 1 in a billion, like the earth would have to, I don't know, what's the expression? Hell would freeze over. Something extreme has to happen that a 1's getting any sort of response from a 10. 1 in a million, 1 in 100,000. It seems to be in the neighborhood of about 14% for men, much higher for women. There have been
for men reaching out to women is 14% or the other way?
For 14%, and for women maybe 35%. Now, that's just getting a response.
Right.
The response could be, go fuck yourself, I hate you. Like, look at yourself.
That didn't include that part.
That didn't include that part. And there have been other studies converging on similar numbers using more advanced metrics. I think it's unambiguous that the odds of getting a yes when you ask someone out are higher. When you ask someone even very desirable out, are probably higher than most people suspect. And when you do the math on that, so I've done this. You probably listen to these podcasts. If you have a 14% chance of getting 1 yes, if you do it 30 times, you have approaching 99% chance of getting 1 yes.
Crazy.
So just, but no guy does that. Not no guy does that. Some guys,
very few,
or some woman. Even I'll say, like, heterosexual women, there have been studies that the biggest improvement of heterosexual women's dating prospects is reaching out to men they want to date. Hmm. That advice to play hard to get is the worst advice I've ever seen. And I think it plays into people's insecurity. No way. Like, ask tons of people out. If you're interested, ask. And that's true in dating. It's true in job applications. There have been studies that scientists can increase the number of interviews they get just by applying to more jobs. Hmm. And all the work scientists put into their careers, just like flood the market, apply everywhere. It's when it's easy. So you were talking about me reaching out. Once you have an email prompt, like, so I started, you know, I promote Don't Trust Your Gut, and I had some interviews that did really well. I had some articles that went viral. So now I wrote up an email that just explains these are all the success I've had, and now I just flood the market with that email. And then, you know, most people don't respond, but occasionally someone does respond. So that's an underrated strategy, because the worst that happens is they don't respond, or the worst that happens is they email you. I flooded the market asking for blurbs for my first book, and two people said something really mean to me in response. Like, I think it was Scott Adams, the Dilbert guy, was like, if your next question is, will I blurb your book? The answer is no, or something. It was like, it was just like very, like, kind of made me feel crappy. It stung. Yeah. It was like, ooh, that's, that hurts. Nobody likes hearing, like, someone you respect being like, no, 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 no way. And kind of almost like, you shouldn't have even asked me. That was inappropriate. But how did that hurt my life? There was zero negative cost to my life. And for every, you know, Scott Adams response, I had all these other people saying these nice things and blurb my book. So, I mean,
it worked out.
Works out, yeah.
So your first book, it turns out Bill Gates read it. How did that feel?
Yeah, that was before. Now he's a more controversial figure after.
After what?
I guess the Melinda divorce and stuff. Yeah, I don't know. He went through I feel like his reputation went down a lot.
So maybe you can't mention that anymore?
No, I don't care. It is true, though. Now you write a book, I wanted to include a line. I've been a huge Woody Allen fan my whole life, and I love some of his quotes. And, you know, I got advice from my editor, like, don't include the Woody Allen quote because he's kind of disgraced now.
Gotcha. And Woody Allen blurbed your book or had a quote about it?
No, I just had quotes. I just had quotes in my book.
Gotcha.
Like Woody Allen said, as Woody Allen said, and they're like, cut that. It's not, it's going to turn people off.
It's so just interesting. Do you think that's right? Like, it's like if you had a quote from Bill Cosby, right? Yeah. Like, is that a negative? Like, I don't know. I don't know the right answer.
I don't know the date. I'd have to see the date on it. Philosophically, I think it's wrong. I think you can separate the art from the artist. And I just wasn't going to, like, put my foot down. It's in part because I didn't know the data. Maybe, you know, maybe they're right that it would turn, a lot of people would be really turned off by hearing that Woody Allen quote. But yeah, no, Bill Gates was just, he was quoting an article saying that he found my book super interesting. Everybody lies, super interesting, but that he didn't like that Everybody Lies is kind of a funny book because it's just, I just explored everything I'm interested in with no purpose to the exercise. So I'm just like, I have these huge sections on human sexuality.
You were going to call the book How Big Is My Penis?
Yeah, that's right. Because that's a Google search people make. They ask Google, how big is my penis? And it's such a ridiculous question. I mean, Google can't answer that question for you, right? So I just thought that was such a funny quote. I was going to call my book that. I think it did have that flavor of, these are just amusing facts. Mm. About the world. And Bill Gates, he's like, it's super interesting, but I didn't know what's the point of all this. I wish he had gone into the point of what to do with all this data, which I kind of think is in many ways what this book is, which is really much more how you can use this data instead of just, did you know that Indian men want to be breastfed by their wives, which I hadn't known before, which I talk about in Everybody Lies. So
it was fascinating seeing how you came to the conclusion for what to write this book about was to look at the highlights of the previous book, even though everyone told you they liked certain things about political things you mentioned or inequality. What they actually were caring about was themselves. And you're like, okay, if that's what is actually people want, I'm going to just devote a book to this.
Yeah, it's and there have been actually more extensive studies where the word that most increases the odds of a sentence being underlined in Amazon Kindle is the word you.
Yeah.
Which is just, it's kind of sad. It's like, we're all so self-absorbed.
Yeah.
And that this book is for you. it's for the you out there where it's, this is how you can make better decisions. And I've definitely noticed it so far in, you know, some of my friends have written books that I think are more important than my book and in many ways better executed than my book. But it's very hard for them to get anybody to pay attention. Whereas I'm like, here's how you can get rich. Here's how you can be happier. Here's how you can date better. Here's how you can date out of your league. And I was like, oh, yeah, yeah, please tell me.
So what's the Mona Lisa test?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So the Mona Lisa effect, I hadn't known this, that the reason the Mona Lisa is the most famous painting in the world, the Mona Lisa was hanging at the Louvre forever. For many, many years, and it was just another painting at the Louvre, and then it was stolen. There was a heist, and it became a worldwide phenomenon of who stole the Mona Lisa. And that for a while, Pablo Picasso was a suspect. J.P. Morgan was a suspect. There's a great book on this, The Vanished Smile, about the whole heist. And it got so much attention that everybody wanted to now see this painting when they actually recovered the painting, which it was stolen by some low-level employee. There was no great punchline. When it came back, everybody wanted to see that painting that they'd been reading about. And now everybody thinks it's the greatest painting in human history, but clearly it just got, in many ways, lucky. You would think unlucky being stolen, but lucky from the perspective of attention and fame and notoriety. And I think it shows the randomness of success in art.
Yeah.
That these, you know, it's much artistic success has much less to do with the quality of the art and much more to do with random things that happened that take it into the stratosphere.
It also highlights the Streisand effect, which is the idea that Barbara Streisand wanted to hide her house and no one could see her house, and that in turn just made her house more visible and more people wanted to put photos out of it. And it's similar to, like, if you want this book to be seen by more people, try to have like libraries burn it can't read it, because that's just going to make people more interested. Why can't I read it? What's going on there? So
for sure. So that's one implication. The other implication is the value of having more work out there for in the world,
more chances.
The fame and the money you make from a piece of art flow directly from the quality of that piece of art, I'd say spend 10, 20 years honing your art and making it perfect, so that's literally the best it could possibly be. But because there's this random element to it, kind of the more work you have out there, the more chances you have for someone to steal it or someone to do something that takes you into the stratosphere. And there have been studies, very compelling studies, of a very strong relationship between quantity of art produced and quality measured in various different ways, that a lot of the most famous artists in history just put tons of work out there, and they themselves didn't even know which piece of art would resonate with the world. They just kind of flooded the market with their crap. No, I'm not going to say their crap. They flooded the market with their craft, and they let the world kind of make a few of them legendary.
Right.
And yeah.
So did that make you more inclined to write 100 books or write more?
It did. And I definitely, so I also talk about don't pre-reject yourself. And a lot, this goes with dating, that, you know, a lot of times you want to ask someone out and you're like, come on, you're a one, they're a 10, or you're a five, they're a 10, or you're whatever you are in your head. You have no chance. And you say, you know, I'm not gonna even bother. And I've done this in my past. Like, I didn't apply. I said I got into Stanford with a sports essay. I didn't apply to Harvard because I thought Harvard was obviously outside my capabilities.
And then you got your PhD there.
I got my PhD there. And it's also, in hindsight, that was so incredibly stupid, because if Stanford was in my capabilities, like,
so was Harvard.
At least I had a 5% chance. And if you have a 5% chance, go for it.
Why do you think we reject ourselves so much?
I don't know. It's so common.
We need to see the data on that. Like, what is, because it's such a common thing, like imposter syndrome. I can't see myself at Harvard. I can't be a Harvard student, because you've seen it so often. But why can't we see ourselves at the grandest stage? Why can't we see ourselves as the best version of ourselves?
Yeah, I don't know. But it seems to be pretty universal. And the more you can overrule it, but I was just saying that don't trust your gut, that I did have an instinct. My gut instinct was, this book is terrible. Don't put it out there. And I learned in researching the book, and I wrote about that this is a very common phenomenon for artists, that Bruce Springsteen, before he released Born to Run, one of the great albums of all time, like just a classic, legendary album, he thought it was garbage and didn't want to put it out there. And his manager had to basically beg him to release it to the world. And that did help me. I'm not claiming that this is the Born to Run of nonfiction books, but it did help me say, okay, you know, I might not be seeing this clearly, and there may be things in this book that that are better than I realize. And putting work out there, and it's happened with articles I've written where I'm just like, this is so stupid. Who's going to want to read this? And then it turns out a lot of people want to read it, and I've struggled, I think, more than most people with pre-rejecting myself. Maybe not more than most people. Maybe it's just like a common thing, but I try to get over it because it's such a bad
instinct. Yeah. Speaking of Born to Run, you had a 2018 New York Times article where you mentioned you had an argument with your brother about whether Born to Run was the greatest song of all time, and you had an interesting conclusion, which I'd heard about before, but didn't realize that it was from you, or maybe you uncovered it from someone else. You'll have to tell me that the age in which males have the most fondness towards music, particular music, is age 13, and females it's age 14. And I thought that was so fascinating. I'd heard that before. I reference it all the time, mentioned it probably a few times in this podcast, but did you come up with that?
Yeah, that was my study. So using Spotify data.
Wow.
So you can actually, I reach out to Spotify. This is another pre-reject. Don't pre-reject yourself. A lot of people are like, how do you get so much data? And a lot of times I just email people and ask.
Yeah.
So I emailed Spotify. I'm like, hey, you have all this data on what songs are popular of men and women of very, very narrow age buckets, 35-year-old, 36-year-old, 37-year-olds. True. We can see what songs are most popular, how old people were when the songs they love were most popular. You see these really sharp patterns it's even, the interesting thing is, men is 1 year younger than women, which maybe has to do with puberty, kind of something. Yeah, I don't know. They're interesting. But the data is so rich from that Spotify data set that the pattern is just like really, really sharp. But yeah.
One thing I asked Tiago Forte about in, I think, my last podcast or a couple podcasts ago was about, how does having access to all this data hurt us in any way? Are there ways in which we're not thinking where we're changing our behavior? Or like, I know baseball has, so this is the example that came to mind, was Jeff McNeil on the Mets. Now being, because of shifts, he's so much better able to plug balls into different places. So does data hurt us in any way that we're not thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it does. So one way definitely is that A/B tests are so powerful. I talk about this in Everybody Lies, the value of A/B tests, that we're all kind of lab rats for these big companies. And Facebook is, anytime they think of changing their website, they show the new version to 1,000 people, the old version to 1,000 people, see which one leads to more engagement on their site. And these tools are so ridiculously powerful, though, that many of us, probably most of us, are addicted to social media from it. And that's because I think it's been said that data scientists, they're spending all their time trying to get you hooked on their site. So that's definitely a negative to the power of data. But I think the negative uses of data have gotten so much attention. There was the Cambridge Analytica scandal, and there have been books, Weapons of Math Destruction by Kathy O'Neill, talks about dangers of algorithms making decisions for us and being treated as an average instead of an individual could be another cost to data. But I try to be more positive in my books because there's so many people negative. I'm like, look at all these amazing things we can learn from data. And I don't think there's any huge negative in learning, you know, what tends to make people happy, you know, the mappiness study that I feature, and what actually leads to long-term happiness in a relationship. That's just good to know. I can't really think of too many negatives that would come from that.
Yeah. No, I like how you take the optimistic approach as well. And I think it's important to realize that it's like there's so much out there. There's more data than ever that allows us to make better decisions. And that's obviously what the whole thing is about. And it's really, really helpful and impactful. So thank you for the work. I mean, it's incredible.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I mean, the money ball and baseball analogy, I do feel like we're in the early innings of this. And this is kind of outlining the starts of, I think, a real revolution in how we make decisions. Similarly, when the Moneyball first came out, it was a little rough.
Right.
Like, it was rough around the edges. Or Moneyball was based on this cybermetrician, Bill James, who I was obsessed with when I was a kid. And he was working at a pork and bean factory, and he was obsessed with baseball. And he started using computers and data, and he'd crunch the numbers and find all these patterns. And some of what Bill James discovered was totally revolutionary. The value of walks was a Bill James discovery originally. And sometimes he just like fire numbers, he just like pick them out of his, you know, out of wherever. And they weren't really, there was kind of a mixture of really, really useful stuff and
signal and noise.
And, you know, I do think some people come back and say, you know, can we actually use data on the neighborhoods people grow up in to pick a place to live? Maybe it's a little too early to make that decision. And I'd kind of agree that it's the early stages of that, but we're getting there.
Yeah.
Like, we're starting to, like, some areas I think just are 100% like, yeah, you can make different decisions based on data. The stuff on nature, the data on the value of nature for happiness is so compelling.
What is that?
So the mappiness study, they found that the same person doing the same activity with the same people, if they're in nature, they're just happier, particularly if they're by a body of water, a lake, a sea, the ocean, just like a big boost in happiness.
Yeah.
And that's just like, you read those studies, there have been follow-up studies showing similar things. It's really compelling. And I think all of us have to think, are we spending enough time in nature, particularly, you know, those of us who live in a city?
Yeah.
Like, that's right away actionable. That's the equivalent of walks in baseball.
Yeah.
Like, good to go.
Go to nature.
Yeah, the data's there. We're not doing enough of it. It's undervalued. If you're not spending, you know, many hours a week in nature, you're
losing out on happiness.
Oh, yeah. I would bet my life on it.
Yeah.
Some of the data, you know, people can decide when they're reading it. Some of it may be, you know, a little bit not 100% there, but some of the stuff is 100% there.
What do you think? One of the questions that's really been the most impactful of my life is like, what are we doing today that we're going to look back on and say, that was really dumb? The thing that I always think about is like, it wasn't that long ago that smoking was prevalent, doctors were saying to do it, and it was commonplace in society. What is our version of smoking today from your perspective?
I think so. The evidence on social media is pretty compelling. Mm. The mappiness study found of 27 leisure activities, the one that makes people the least happy is social media. And there have been randomized controlled trials. They've paid people to quit Facebook. There have been more that have come out since I wrote my book, paying people to get off TikTok, Twitter, big boost in mood. So I think it's pretty, that's another one where that one's been harder for me to follow because it's a little addictive. But
how do you balance that when being an independent creative today almost requires you to be on these platforms?
Yeah, but I don't have to be on Facebook as much as I'm on Facebook.
Facebook Newsfeed Eradicator is the single best Chrome extension that completely demolished my Facebook.
Oh, I don't
Facebook.
Even know that.
Yeah, go to the Chrome store and check out Facebook Newsfeed Eradicator. It's incredibly helpful. I haven't been on Facebook in like probably 3-4 years just from downloading that app.
Wow.
What it does is the home feed is gone. So it's like you go
Facebook. It's old school Facebook. You have to search for people's.
Exactly. No news feed at all. And it's just way less addicting. And you can still use it if you want. So worth considering for anyone with the Facebook addiction. Twitter, yeah. I haven't really saw.
Twitter, it. Once you get into the top 1% or top 0.1%, you just hire someone to do the tweeting for you, right? Then you can get off it.
No, I'll never get to that level. I love it, man. You know, when you love it, tweeting and connecting with people, it's hard. But for you, where do you think your biggest addiction personally lies?
The sports ones, really. Sports. Maybe. I've lost. I've had some rough. Like that paper hit me so hard because when I look back at my life, I'm like, wow, I have had some rough nights based on my team losing rough weeks. Like I really, if you're a big sports fan, like it can lead to pretty wild mood swings. That I don't know. It's pretty. That study did make me rethink things. Yeah, obviously for non-sports fans, it's not gonna make them rethink, but it's a pretty big cost, because I think I may even swing more than the average sports fan. And I did the math. If you do their calculation, then like if you root for four teams like I do and you kind of do the math, you're basically giving yourself like an additional flu a year, like because sick in bed is the worst,
right?
The activity that gives the lowest happiness. And sports fandom, if you like a lot of teams, you're really into the games as I am, if you're really getting more pain from the losses and you're getting pleasure from the wins, you are losing a lot. But I would say the happiness, I don't know if it's one thing, but the happiness studies in general, this is a little extreme, but I view the Mappiness Project as an indictment on modern life. Because you look at, so Mappiness rates 40 activities by how much average happiness they give. And it was a study by George McCarron and Alex Bryson. And the top activities are almost all these activities that you imagined us doing as hunter-gatherers. Having sex is number one. Hunting and fishing is near the top. Taking a walk, socializing with friends. Many of them are, you know, outdoors in nature, you know, running around, exercise. It's like very old school. You could imagine hunter-gatherers doing them. And then you look at the bottom activities and it's all this bureaucracy of modern life. It's like standing on lines and waiting, doing chores and taxes and filling out forms. That just does not make people happy. And I do think the happiness stuff to me says many of us are living our lives really wrong and not doing enough of spending time in nature, these other activities that make people really, really happy. They're kind of old fashioned.
Have you done any of these on yourself? Meaning like asked yourself the questions while doing it? Because I feel like that would almost be more impactful than looking at a sample of 100 million people as like, a sample of one of yourself, like how happy do I get when my sports team wins? How sad do I get when they lose?
I haven't done it officially, so I haven't actually like sat down and create an app and track myself, which may be the next version. I do think also we exaggerate how different we are from average people. So there have been some really interesting studies on these happiness pinging people. They've compared extroverts and introverts.
Yeah.
And how much of a mood boost they get being around people.
It's the same.
It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
So yeah, introverts, extroverts are getting the equivalent mood boost from being around people, even though introverts would probably tell you, you know, I know the definition of introverts is a little more subtle involving energy replenishing, but I think a lot of introverts, if you ask them, they'd say, well, they really don't get this big boost from being around people. So I think we have to be a little cautious in assuming, you know, well, I don't care about nature. I don't love weather doesn't affect me. Or anytime someone says that they're very different from the average person and what makes them happy, I'd be a little, my guess is the truth is somewhere in between what you think and what the average happiness study would say.
Yeah, no, but it's interesting because I feel like you probably get more joy from writing than the average person.
No, that's 100% wrong. Writing makes me miserable.
But the finished product, maybe? Like, for example, playing basketball. I'm not going to get as much joy from that as LeBron James, I would argue. And that's because he's really talented at it, and it's a joy for him and playing. And but maybe I'm wrong.
You could be wrong. I think, yeah, clearly there's some individual variation. If people just said, you know, they're going to do just the activities that make the average person happy, I'd say that's a, you know, questionable approach. But I think we exaggerate the level of individual variation. Anybody, my guess is anybody would get on average a happiness boost if they just force themselves to do the activities that make the average person happy. So gardening makes people happy.
Interesting.
And like, I think I would think about that. I'm like, come on, gardening. Like, I like lying on my couch watching sports. I'm not a gardening type. I think I'd be wise to keep in mind that the average person gets such pleasure from gardening and try it out. And I might be surprised by how much pleasure it gives me. So I take your point that there is individual variation. I think we're too easily convinced that we're special and unique and go against these averages.
What about the difference between meaning and happiness, right? Like, work ranked very low for a lot of people, but maybe, and if you ask somebody while they're doing exercises during physical fitness, they might not be so happy doing a specific movement or a specific exercise, but they might be more happy after the fact. Is there any meaning variation for the happiness?
Yeah, for sure. There's, you know, I focus more on just the moment-to-moment pleasure, and partly I'm just a pure utilitarian. Like, I studied philosophy as an undergrad, and I'm just like, yeah, just maximize pleasure, minimize
David
pain.
Hume is your favorite
David
philosopher.
David Hume is my favorite philosopher, and he was really very high on the utilitarian scale. So I kind of, like, philosophers are like, it's better to be Socrates unsatisfied than a pig satisfied. And I never bought it. I'm like, I'd rather be the happy pig than Socrates miserable, even though Socrates presumably lives a more meaningful life. So that's just philosophically, I differ from people.
Makes sense.
But definitely there's difference between things that, some things give you pain in the short term, but may give you long-term happiness. So my advice, I conclude the book that basically, after reading all the happiness studies, I think basically the answer to life is just sex on the beach. That seems to be where they all converge.
Yeah.
On, you know, the being by water, being a nature. Beautiful area, nature, sex, being with your romantic partner makes you happiest. Obviously, I don't know that someone can go through their entire life having sex on the beach. Oh, maybe, yeah, maybe you could most of it. you know, probably it wears off at some point, and you'd, if you just literally just move to a beach and just with your romantic partner and just were constantly doing nothing but having sex, you might feel like you're wasting your existence. Well, maybe not. I don't know. I need to hear. I want, like, people who've tried out this advice to tell me how it's going. Yeah.
So kind of switching gears here, your mom. Yeah. Your mom gave you the best advice, which was, she told you not to become a professional athlete and to stop spending so much time playing sports and instead focus on math and writing where you have more potential. What was that advice?
Well, I'm not lying on this. The hardest day I ever had in my life by a wide margin was my mom sat me down on a couch and told me I wasn't going to be a professional athlete. That was a couple years ago. No, just sure. I think I was probably like 7 or 8. And, you know, like when they ask a kid, they say, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And my answer was always professional athlete, professional athlete, professional athlete. And everyone thought, oh, that's so adorable. Seth doesn't know that he's not going to be first base. You know, he's not going to be the next Keith Hernandez, first baseman for the Mets, the next Patrick Ewing, center for the Knicks. And I think it got to a point where it went from cute to just a little weird. Like, how does this kid not realize that he's not going to be a professional athlete?
What age was that?
Probably like, I mean, there's, I'd say like, I don't remember exactly what I say, 6. Maybe, yeah, probably a little later than that. Probably like, I don't know. I don't remember, 10, 12. So there was some age where you know, your parents know genetics, and there was no genetic athletic, there was no athletic talent in my gene pool, and they know size, and,
right.
you know, I'm not LeBron James. I wasn't on path to be 6'8", and so I think there was, there's probably always a disconnect. Your parents, you know, kind of how you're, what your kid's likely to be good at and what your kid's not likely to be good at, and yeah, my mom, it was, like, heartbreaking. I'm just like, because it's all I wanted. I've talked about it in both my books. Both my books, I have a section about how I wanted to be a professional athlete because it really was this fundamental core aspect of my childhood was my love of sports. So I wrote the college essay about it. It was just so much of my identity revolved around sports. And I wasn't horrible. Like, I was pretty coordinated, but I was nobody was saying this is the next LeBron James.
So wrapping it up here, what would you say is, like, from everything you've written, what would you say is the core lesson you could take away and give to somebody listening or watching, is like, in one idea or one sentence, what is, like, everything you've written about?
We're living through an explosion of data that is transforming our understanding of the most important areas of human life. And whether you want to just save the world, improve your own life, understand the world, it's incredible. When I was researching this book, I was shocked. Each chapter, I told you I had no idea what I was going to write. And each time, I'm just like, oh my God, that project that I didn't know about is so amazing and is totally transforming my understanding of this area of life.
That's a beautiful place to come to a close. Seth, thank you so much for your writing, your advice, your ability to communicate complex ideas in simple ways. It's an absolute pleasure to read, and I'm so grateful for you spending time here today. So thank you for being here. Where can we send people to connect with you further?
I'm on Twitter, even though it makes me miserable, at Seth S_D. So my hyphenated last name, Seth S_D.
Yeah. We'll link that below. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks, Danny.